mud had all but obliterated his appetite. "Then I'll be happy to take you back to Sherborne Hall. My wife is looking forward to meeting you, and I'm in need of sustenance myself." Radnor walked with them to Sherborne's waiting gig, where a boy stood holding the Marquis's horse. Brantford would cheerfully have waved goodbye to the Marquis of Medling, but his vexatious lordship merely steered his horse to walk along beside the carriage.
"Where is your next destination, Brantford?" Sherborne asked, giving the reins a shake. "Will you return to London, tarry here in Wales, or repair to your family seat?"
"I haven't decided. The hospitality at Haverford Castle is outstanding, and I'm not anxious to subject myself to another week on the King's Highway so soon."
Sherborne drove well, but he was turned out in the first stare of casual gentlemanly fashion. The beast in the traces was sleek and muscular, and the gig well-sprung. Resentment welled, because a small irrational part of Brantford had been hoping to see Sherborne fail. Why should wealth come to a man who had no great standing, no particular learning, no family of any consequence? Why shouldn't Sherborne have to struggle a bit, or more than a bit? Though not too much, Brantford did need rather badly for this investment to be profitable.
"That's your home?"
Brantford asked as they topped a rise, and a stately country house came into view.
"My home, and the former dower house for Haverford Castle. We purchased it from the St. David's in German George's day, and each generation has kept the house modernized in every particular."
How proud he was of a mere jumped-up manor house, though his residence did have rather a lot of windows. Also a fine formal garden that led to a park, which transitioned to cultivated land and pastures. The outbuildings were nicely placed behind the main house, a carriage house and a sizable stable, a summer kitchen, laundry and spring house, among others. Gravel walks joined the buildings and trimmed hedges marked off the gardens. The premises were, in fact, about the same size as the Brantford estate in Yorkshire.
"Will you join us for dinner, Radnor?"
Brantford asked.
"Alas for me, no. I'm expected to relay a report of the day's business to Haverford, before I join my lady wife for supper."
Brantford hadn't exactly made a map of the neighbourhood, but surely Radnor's errands took him in the opposite direction, back to Haverford Castle, rather than along this bucolic lane.
"You could send a note," Sherborne said. "Have Lady Radnor join us. Mrs. Sherborne would be delighted to have her ladyship share another meal with us."
Another meal, meaning Sherborne regularly entertained the Marquis. Radnor had a hand in running the mine. Sherborne had married the Duke of Haverford's sister-in-law, and by escorting Sherborne back to his home, Radnor was sending a clear signal to any presuming earls. Sherborne had allies, close at hand and well-placed. And yet the Duke had not invested in this mine, while Brantford had. Perhaps dinner would afford a tired, hungry earl far from home several opportunities to remind his host of that salient fact.
"His lordship is a bumpkin," Charlotte said, setting a pot of heartsease on the bedroom mantel. "He talked about nothing save his collieries in Yorkshire and his sporting acquaintances. Was he much of a pest at the works?"
She should have written to her family and gleaned their opinions of Brantford, for he'd been a disappointment in fine tailoring. Sherborne closed and locked the bedroom door.
"Radnor nannied us at every turn, which I gather was at Haverford's insistence. My sense is that Brantford knows little of mining, and while he could have interrogated me at length for the benefit of his own education, which would have earned my esteem, he wasn't about to appear ignorant before Radnor or before you."
Charlotte stood in front of her husband and slipped the pin from his cravat.
"For his pride, he does not have your esteem. Sleeve buttons, please."
Sherborne offered her his right hand, then his left, and she slipped the fastenings at his wrists free.
"Pride doesn't offend me, Charlotte. I'm proud. I hope I'm not arrogant. I can undress myself."
She undid his pocket watch next, then set his jewellery on the vanity and went after the knot in his cravat.
I am your wife, and undressing you is my pleasure.
He tipped his chin up. You mean that?
I spoke vows. You did too. Shall I order you a bath?
She folded his cravat over the back of a chair.
No, thank you. I did nothing today that came close to qualifying as physical exertion. My thanks for a fine meal. You have quite the treasure trove of recipes.
Our cook has recipes, too, but she was loath to try them on you without an invitation. Shall you take off your shoes?
He settled into the chair by the hearth, his sigh redolent of weariness, from a man who hadn't exerted himself.
Are you relieved to have Brantford's visit behind you?
Charlotte certainly was. I should be. Might you sit for a moment, Mrs. Sherborne?
Charlotte took a seat on the hassock, though sitting still was difficult. Her first true guest beyond family had come to dinner, and nothing had gone wrong. Or had it?
What did you and Brantford talk about over the port?
Sherborne bent to remove his shoes. He set them aside and regarded the fire blazing in the hearth.
Brantford is unhappy with the terms of our agreement. He waited all day to ambush me, until neither you nor Radnor could hear him express dismay at the schedule upon which his investment will be repaid.
Nothing of Brantford's displeasure had been evident when Charlotte had rejoined the men for a final cup of tea, before sending Brantford back to Haverford Castle. He'd been the gracious, smiling, lordly guest, bowing with friendly presumption over Charlotte's hand.
"You are unhappy with Brantford," Charlotte said,
taking her husband's feet into her lap.
"Have you a fascination with my feet, Mrs. Sherborne?"
"Yes." "You might offer to rub my feet at some point if I bring you pleasure often enough by rubbing yours.
Or you might not be upset with me when I find a moment to tell you about Fern's son and the Mrs. Wesleys, all of the Mrs. Wesleys, including the ones I haven't met yet." Now that Brantford's visit was behind them, Charlotte meant to find that moment soon. Sherborne was a reasonable fellow, and he was her fellow, and Charlotte detested keeping secrets from him. Sherborne scrubbed a hand over his face.
"Brantford signed a contract with me, agreeing that repayment of his investment would be on commercially reasonable terms, determined with my discretion as the owner, major investor and director of the works, but in no event to involve a period of more than 10 years, or less than 5% per annum simple interest."
"If he invested £10,000, then 5% interest per annum on the entire principal over 10 years would be another £5,000. Many people go their whole lives without earning £500.
Sherborne leaned his head back against the cushions as Charlotte pressed her thumbs against his left heel. Achilles had lost his life as a result of an arrow to the left heel, though why that snippet of mythology should occur to her, she did not know.
"Some people go their whole lives without entangling a titled snob in their business," Sherborne said. "I should not have taken what Brantford was offering. Oh, that feels good."
Charlotte pressed harder against his calloused soul.
"Can you untangle yourself from Brantford?"
"Not soon enough. He's in the wrong. He signed a contract that many others have signed regarding similar projects. The agreement is legally sound. But if his lordship takes me to court alleging a defect because the language was too vague, then he can destroy the colliery before we've brought out our first ton of ore. He'll demand all of his money back, plus damages and costs, and make me look like a presuming incompetent."
"Give him his money back now, and tear up the contract. He's not honourable."
Sherborne remained quiet, while Charlotte worked her thumbs all over the bottom of his foot. If anybody had told her a month ago that she'd enjoy massaging her husband's feet, she'd have pronounced that person unhinged. The moment was intimate, and she liked being intimate with her spouse.
"Do you suppose Haverford's watchdog was spying on me?"
he asked.
"Or keeping Brantford from stepping out of line?"
"Radnor might have been acting on his own initiative. He is one of your directors. Give me your other foot."
Radnor made it plain he would drop by Haverford Castle to report on the day's doings before returning home. I know the aristocracy is insular and inbred, but if Radnor sought... Ouch!
Charlotte eased the pressure. Radnor and Haverford do not know Branford any better than you do. I have the sense I might have stood up with him, though I cannot place him. A blonde, blue-eyed earl is hardly a rarity. His looks are unremarkable and his conversation uninspired. And yet I do wonder if I met him somewhere previously.
He bored you at dinner?
He bored me within 5 minutes of the introductions, because he can converse regarding only one topic, himself. I like your crooked toes.
You like my crooked toes, while a peer of the realm bores you. You are an eccentric female, and eccentric females have ever been my favourite exponents of the gender.
Sherborne was. He was flirting with her. Charlotte was almost sure of it. Fatigue has made you daft.
Marriage has made me happy, Charlotte.
He sounded perplexed, and his gaze was on the fire, and yet he sounded pleased, too. Charlotte set his feet on the floor and appropriated a corner of his seat cushion. "Might you undo my hooks and stays?" she asked, sweeping her hair off her nape. Sherborne unfastened her clothing, and Charlotte arranged herself in his lap rather than hurry away to the privacy screen. He wrapped his arms about her, and she cuddled with him before the fire in a state of half-dressed, cosy fatigue. Charlotte drifted off to sleep, wondering where she might have seen Branford before, and hoping she might never see him again.
"Your taste in business partners is disgraceful,"
Haverford passed Sherborne a glass of brandy.
"If ever I owed you more than coin of the realm, my debt to you has been settled in perpetuity." "Likewise,"
Radnor said, lifting his glass so it caught the afternoon sun beaming through the windows of Haverford Castle's library.
"Here's to an earl seen safely on his way."
Sherborne took a sip of exquisite brandy, the very vintage he'd sent Haverford as a wedding present, actually.
"Charlotte pronounced Branford boring," Sherborne said. "My wife is blessed with keen discernment." "Though she married you anyway,"
Radnor murmured. Charlotte had married him, made passionate love with him, rubbed his feet, entertained his guests, and paraded around the churchyard with him, as if she'd happened upon the greatest marital prize of the season. All quite different from Sherborne's expectations.
"And my sister," Haverford said, "for reasons which defy mortal comprehension, is now the Marchioness of Radnor. Here's to our ladies."
Sherborne drank to that, and to the peculiar pleasure of being thanked by the vicar in public and within earshot of most of the congregation for seeing to our long-overdue steeple repairs and with such unstinting generosity. With Charlotte preening at Sherborne's side, he'd been given odd looks, tentative smiles, and maybe even a few envious glances from the local squires. Then, in full view of the shire's biggest busybodies, Haverford had offered an impromptu invitation to Sunday dinner at the castle.
"How is Her Grace?" Sherborne asked,
as Haverford rolled a ladder along a two-story expanse of bookshelves.
"She seemed in good spirits at services." "She is relieved to be shut of Branford," Haverford said, climbing the ladder. "What a tedious excuse for a house-guest! He discovered where the maid stairs were, and frequented them at every opportunity, such that Her Grace decreed the maids and footmen were to switch staircases for the duration of Branford's visit." "What's different about this room?"
Radnor asked, steadying the ladder at the bottom.
"Something has changed."
Sherborne took his drink up the spiral steps with him, to the section of the shelves reserved for cookery and herbals, for surely Haverford had a volume of recipes Charlotte would enjoy.
"What's different," he said, "is that I have paid to ship half the books that used to collect dust on yonder shelves into the hinterlands of Wales. Somewhere some tavern maid is struggling through Candide, while a younger brother fancies himself a Lilliputian or a Yahoo."
Which was progress of a sort Haverford would never have stumbled on without the aid of his duchess and his neighbour. As a result, the library was lighter, airier, less of a cave, more of a gracious retreat. The scent was the same, though, the vanilla fragrance of old books, a tang of peat, and a mellow undertone of beeswax and lemon.
"I can count on my thumb the number of hours Brantford spent in here,"
Haverford said, taking out a book, pushing it back among its confreres, then taking down another.
"We still have one of the finest collections of reading material in the realm, and his lordship was more interested in bothering the help, or talking me into taking him to a local hunt meet."
"He wanted to be seen with you," Sherborne selected a volume on French desserts. "He did not want to be seen with me."
"While you add coin to his coffers," Radnor muttered. "Not well done of him."
"I will make very sure that Brantford and I belong to none of the same clubs," Haverford said, making a slow descent, while holding a book in his hand. "The man lacks couth."
Looking down on the Duke and the Marquis, Sherborne's first thought was that he was being subtly rebuked for having associated with Brantford. Another hypothesis suggested itself. The Duke and the Marquis were ashamed of Brantford, ashamed that a peer of the realm had acted so disagreeably, so dishonourably, to use Charlotte's term.
"I apologize for inflicting Brantford on you both," Sherborne said, closing the book of recipes. "If I could refund his investment and send him on his way, I would."
The apology was as rare as it was sincere, and yet more words marched forth into the comfortable elegance of the ducal library.
"His lordship threatened litigation if I failed to interpret the terms of our contract liberally. He reminded me that his cousin is a judge. His dear cousin."
Her Grace had towed Sherborne all over this library countless times in recent weeks, but today was different, because he was an invited guest. 10 feet below, Haverford passed Radnor the book. The view from the mezzanine suggested Radnor would go bald before Haverford did. Even that indignity apparently respected the order of precedence. Radnor glanced up from the book.
"Brantford threatened you with a lawsuit not a month after agreeing to do business with you?"
"The Earl was subtle enough to leave a margin of ambiguity," Sherborne said, descending the steps. "He is not happy with the terms he agreed to, though I've guaranteed him at least as good a return as the cent per cents, and my own investment will be repaid on the same terms. I'm to improve those terms for him or deal with his displeasure. He awaits correspondence from me confirming my renewed understanding of our association."
Haverford took the reading chair by the fireplace and crossed his feet at the ankles.
"Does he want his money back?" "I asked him that, and he laughed. He invested in my works, and now I'm to make him rich."
"Somebody ought to make him humble," Radnor said. "The man's a disgrace."
A lingering residue of self-doubt wafted away with Radnor's words. Sherborne had confidence in his own commercial abilities and confidence in his grasp of the law. He worked hard and had a fair degree of common sense. Where he'd erred was in assuming that a man born to wealth, title, and standing would also claim the integrity that should accompany such blessings. Radnor and Haverford confirmed that Sherborne's expectations had been reasonable, not naive, not stupid.
"Brantford is my disgrace for now," Sherborne said. "I cannot risk litigation or scandal, or even his lordship's enmity in the clubs. I've recently married well above myself, and my liquid resources are at low ebb. If I do as his lordship wishes and make him a fortune, then I benefit as well."
Haverford scowled at his drink.
"It could not be that rational, that pragmatic or mature, in the face of such arrogance. He doesn't need another fortune, and investing with you was hardly taking a great risk. I'd be tempted to plant such an audacious creditor a facer."
Haverford was every inch the Duke at his leisure. His Sunday attire was pristine, beautifully tailored, and adorned with his signature touches of lace and luxury. Despite his rank, he was merely commiserating with a neighbour and in-law over a turn of bad luck. A cat leaped into Haverford's lap, inspiring the Duke to swear affectionately and set his drink aside. purring rumbled forth as His Grace scolded the cat and scratched its chin. I must get my wife a kitten. That thought, which brought Charlotte to mind, was followed closely by another. I owe Haverford an apology.
I was an ass, Sherborne said, before caution got the better of him. As a creditor, I was an ass, Haverford. I am sorry for it. I should have shown you how to restructure your notes when you came into the title, should have written off the old Duke's obligation.
Radnor apparently found the view out the corner window fascinating.
The old Duke should not have been such a profligate spendthrift, Haverford said, and by failing to accelerate delinquent notes, you essentially did restructure them. What do you suppose the ladies are gossiping about?
Feminine mysteries, Radnor said, turning from the window. Names for babies. Glenys is honestly considering Galahad, if it's a boy.
The expectant fathers fretted about odd names that might befall their offspring. When a child was saddled with 6 or 8 names from birth, much nonsense could creep onto the list. Sherborne sipped his drink and missed his wife. Charlotte would know if Haverford had accepted Sherborne's apology, rejected it, or simply been embarrassed by it. Sherborne didn't particularly care. He'd tendered the apology that honour demanded, and that was what mattered. Charlotte would be proud of him, which also mattered, and that might give him the courage to rub her feet.
Chapter 18 "Does Mr. Sherborne know what you're about?"
Miss Macpherson's tone was polite but firm, such as a senior servant used on a child found outside the nursery at an odd hour. She'd come upon Charlotte making a Monday morning call at the Cardenwall household, and had accepted a ride back to the village.
"Mr. Sherborne is too busy with the colliery to be bothered with my social schedule," Charlotte replied. "He has his charitable undertakings, and I have mine." "He's putting the steeple to rights," Miss Macpherson said, retying her bonnet ribbons. "Papa will be very wroth if Mr. Sherborne withdraws his support from that project."
Old anger stirred, startling in its intensity.
"Do you mean that putting a pretty steeple on the church is more important than seeing Maureen Cardenwell's baby thrive? I mean that we can't have masonry plummeting from the heavens onto parishioners' heads, Mrs. Sherborne."
For about a quarter mile, the only sound was the hoofbeats of the gelding in the traces and the crunch of the gig's wheels on the lane. The fine weather had held, perhaps the last of the year. Along the tree lines, each breeze sent more leaves twirling down to join the carpet below. The undergrowth was dying back with brilliant reds and yellows among the sombre browns. The day was beautiful, and Charlotte made up her mind to take her husband a picnic lunch once she'd delivered her passenger.
"You doubtless surprised the Cardenwalls with your generosity," Miss Macpherson said. "I hadn't thought to collect fabric for them."
Infants needed clothing, and even scraps could be stitched together into quilts and dresses.
"Winter approaches, and the child must be kept warm."
Charlotte had barely set both feet over the cottage threshold, staying only long enough to introduce herself and leave a basket and a bundle. Maureen had been terrified into near speechlessness, while her mother had accepted Charlotte's offerings with quiet dignity. Poverty had been evident in the household's painful tidiness, threadbare carpets, and empty quarter shelves in the front room. No cut work, no framed embroidery, no charmingly amateurish sketch of the baby, no embroidery half-finished in a work-basket. But for the half-dozen plump hens in the yard, Charlotte might have started crying. Griffin had kept his word, and in the coming cold weather his generosity might be all that kept the child healthy.
"You ought to tell Mr. Sherborne where you've been," Miss Macpherson said, as she climbed down from the gig outside the vicarage. "I've no business presuming to give you advice about your marriage, but Mr. Sherborne isn't the greedy brute some people would believe him to be."
"Miss Macpherson, you insult my husband even as you defend him."
and yet Charlotte was just as outspoken as Miss Macpherson when the need arose. The vicar's daughter was also right about honesty between spouses being essential. Anybody who thought Sherborne a greedy brute was an idiot. "I insult my papa's congregation," Miss Macpherson said, shaking out her skirts. "The parish enjoys having Mr. Sherborne to gossip about, and he's the closest thing this valley has to a banker, and he doesn't cheat anybody. Now he's building us a colliery, and that's something Haverford would have prevented to his dying day but for Mr. Sherborne's persistence."
She really was quite fierce. Quite admirable.
Now you insult my brother-in-law. I speak the truth, and mean the Duke no insult. He did find us a lovely duchess, and now Mr. Sherborne has brought you here as well. The valley will benefit from both unions.
She curtsied and came up smiling. Charlotte smiled back and turned the gig for home. Of course, she would tell her husband where she'd been. She would also tell her sister and Lady Radnor, and enlist their aid in developing a plan to keep the curtain walls in chickens and quilts. Doubtless both titled households could contribute some fabric scraps, send the occasional gardener around to help with the heavier tasks, and spare a ham once a quarter or so. Charlotte was happily engrossed in charitable plans as she sailed into the library, intent on jotting down a few ideas. Sherborne sat at his desk, neither reading nor writing. He rose when Charlotte entered, and she approached with intent to hug him thoroughly. He'd torn himself away from the works at midday after all.
"Mrs. Sherborne, good day."
"Mr. Sherborne, you have foiled my plans. I had intended to kidnap you from the works for a picnic, because the weather is so fair."
He propped a hip on the corner of the desk, dropped something from his pocket into the pen tray, and crossed his arms.
"You planned to kidnap me?" he asked.
No warmth shone from his eyes, no welcome. He was again the calculating, self-contained social interloper Charlotte had first encountered months ago at Haverford's house party.
"Have you and Mr. Jones quarrelled?" she asked, drawing off her bonnet.
A hairpin caught in her bonnet ribbons. She couldn't hold the hat and untangle her hair both. And rather than help her, her husband merely watched from several feet away.
"He disdains to touch me."
Charlotte rejected that wayward thought almost before it formed.
"Might you assist me?"
He waited for two unfathomable seconds, then withdrew a pair of shears from the desk drawer. He approached, held up the shears, and Charlotte resigned herself to finding a new ribbon for her bonnet. She held still, though at the last second she realized he intended to cut off a lock of her hair.
"You're free," he said,
holding up the curling strands with a trailing length of ribbon.
"Where have you been, Charlotte?"
A taunt, not friendly marital small talk.
"I've come from the vicarage."
"Is that where you've spent your morning?"
Charlotte tried to tuck the shortened lock behind her ear, though it refused to stay there. She set her bonnet atop the globe that stood near a tall window.
"Lucas, what's wrong?"
He pulled an object from his breast pocket and held it out to her.
"Why would the Earl of Brantford have given you his miniature and signed the back, conveying all of his love, always?"
Charlotte should have laughed, should have refused to touch the object in Sherborne's hand. She should have snatched it from him and tossed it across the room. The very sight of the small portrait made her ill. She hadn't forgotten the miniature, quite, but hadn't made it a point to study the image recently either.
"You searched my jewelry box."
"No, I did not. I have been remiss as a husband. Among my many failings, I've never presented you with a morning gift. I thought to leave you such a gift among your effects, a few baubles, such as I can afford. I have no idea what you prefer in the way of jewels, so I thought to look at what you already own. Instead, I find you've been playing me false with the same man who's trying to all but blackmail me. Did you and Brantford laugh at your cleverness, Charlotte?"
If Sherborne had abandoned her on the highest peak in the land, Charlotte could not have been more bewildered.
"You accuse me of betraying my vows with Brantford?"
"I'm doing you the courtesy of asking you for answers, Charlotte. You had Brantford's miniature secreted where few husbands would ever look. You entertained him with every appearance of gracious good cheer. He's titled. He's of your ilk. He's unscrupulous, and he's in a position to ruin everything I've worked for. He approached me only after the Wyndhams had shown me a cordial welcome to London. What am I to think?"
Charlotte needed to sit down, and the closest available chair was behind Sherborne's desk. She took it, refusing to so much as glance at the miniature in Sherborne's hand. Indignation was trying to push aside other emotions, for Sherborne had reached the worst judgments about her without even hearing her explanation. She was prepared to tell him so when a glint from the pen tray caught her eye. A hairpin tipped with amber, her hairpin, and Sherborne had had it in his pocket, the rogue. If he'd carried this token with him since their betrothal, then he was her rogue, and he was her husband.
"I can see why you are perplexed," Charlotte said. "But that miniature is not the Earl of Brantford. I've had it for years, and it belonged to my dearest friend, the man who gave Fern that portrait and penned such tender sentiments to her, was the complete scoundrel who ruined her and left her to die shortly after bearing his child. I hate him, whoever he might be, and if the opportunity ever arises, I will hold him accountable for his sins."
The clock ticked three times, while Sherborne stared at the small likeness in his hand. Then he stalked across the library and slapped it onto the blotter.
"This is Brantford, Charlotte. Younger, thinner, handsomer, but it's him. Don't put me off with some flimsy lie."
"It's not Brantford. It's one of many blonde, blue-eyed lordlings, whom the portraitists are paid to flatter outrageously. Fern refused to tell me his name, because she knew I'd see him ruined if it was the last thing I did on this earth."
Sherborne's cool facade cracked, to reveal a hint of exasperation.
"Charlotte, this is Brantford. I know his penmanship, and the initials on the back are his. He makes a particularly vain production out of his cues, and the likeness is him."
A chill passed over Charlotte, leaving a queasy weakness in its wake.
"That cannot be Brantford. It's not—"
Sherborne pushed the little painting closer, so Charlotte had merely to tip her chin down to study it. A blonde, bland countenance smiled up at her, though, as she'd said, many a young lord was blonde-haired and blue-eyed, and every one of them smiled. The artist had taken the predictable liberties and flattered the subject, though not unduly. The image was years out of date, too, and age was not improving Brantford's looks. His hair was thinner, his cheeks fuller, his eyes colder. But Charlotte knew that smile. She'd last seen it when he'd bowed his farewells and offered her fine compliments on a lovely meal. She rose, though her knees were none too steady.
"I need to wash my hands."
She needed to be sick, to toss that devil's painting into the fire, to cling to her husband and cry until she had no more tears left.
"You're not making sense, Charlotte. You always make sense."
Concern lurked beneath Sherborne's terse observation.
"He killed my friend Lucas. That vile, rutting, smiling, despicable, mortal sin of a man lied to my friend, struck her, and cast her out when she was with child. It was Brantford, and I've entertained him at my own table. I gave him my hand, I curtsied to him, when I should have driven a knife through his heart."
Charlotte pushed away from the desk, needing to put distance between herself and the image of evil on the blotter. Sherborne caught her before she stumbled, and then Charlotte was weeping uncontrollably against her husband's chest.
"Lucas, he killed my friend.
I cannot bear it. He killed my friend, and there was nothing I could do.
Sherborne swept her up in his arms, settled with her on the sofa, and even produced a much-needed handkerchief. And still Charlotte could not cease weeping. All of Charlotte's passion, her magnificent dignity and decency, fueled hot, miserable tears that wet Sherborne's shirt and broke his heart. She cried for her friend and for her own lost faith in gentlemanly honour. He knew, because this was his wife, the woman he'd been born to partner, the woman who'd frightened him witless when he'd thought she'd played him false, that the last lament was the deepest cut. There was nothing I could do. He held her, he rocked her, he stroked her hair, and kissed her brow, until she slowly quieted.
"I hate him," Charlotte said, voice raspy and low. "Lucas, I will hate him until the day I leave this earth. And should the Almighty consign me to the pit, part of me would rejoice, for there I'd see that human plague rodent, and confront him with the evil he's done."
She meant every word, and old Nick himself would not dare interfere with her vengeance. "Tell me what happened."
"I have told you. Fern was a vicar's daughter, the sweetest, most mischievous, dear young woman ever to help me tie sheets together, so we could dance under a full moon and feel as daring as pagans. We were ridiculous, and I will never have a friend like that again."
"You have me."
"She decided to dance with Brantford under the stars instead."
Charlotte squirmed about and took the place beside Sherborne on the sofa. He tucked an arm around her shoulders, and after a bit of fussing she scooted down to rest her head against his thigh. He draped a quilt over her, her favourite quilt, and wished he'd met his wife before heartache had made her so indomitable.
"Fern did not decide to tryst with Brantford. She knew he was far above her touch. She was introduced to him only because a cousin of his attended the same finishing school we did. I was at Morland's, spending a holiday with my family, while Fern bided at school, and she met Brantford. He charmed her, then struck up a correspondence with her. She initiated none of it, and didn't answer his letters, until he threatened to cast himself from the nearest sea cliff if she continued to ignore him."
"Would that he had."
"I assume you tried to dissuade her."
"I knew nothing of it. He enjoined Fern to secrecy, and for good reason. If I'd suspected that vile abomination was sniffing about her skirts, I'd have set my cousins to chasing him off that cliff at gunpoint."
A shuddery sigh went through her.
"Hate is a taxing emotion. But Brantford deserves my hatred, Lucas. He deserves to be pilloried for the rest of his life."
Charlotte was not meant for hatred, but neither could she tolerate injustice. Sherborne treasured that about her. He needed her moral clarity in his life, needed her common sense and her affection.
"When did you become aware that your friend was conducting a liaison?"
Charlotte bit his thigh.
"Fern did not conduct a liaison. She made a poor family's version of a come-out, and if I'm to believe her, she avoided Brantford. I certainly didn't see her showing favour to any particular man, though she later admitted she'd danced with him occasionally. Brantford's attentions would have been considered gentlemanly, even generous, given the difference in their stations. All the while, he was stealing kisses and tempting her to clandestine meetings."
Very likely Brantford's cronies would have known what he was about, for he would have bragged of his progress and joked about his objective. Men did, and other men pretended not to take the boasting seriously, for then no guilt need trouble them either. The same unspoken rules meant that boys at school could beat Sherborne without mercy, while other boys pretended not to notice.
"When did you learn that your friend had misstepped?"
Charlotte sat up, though she kept the quilt about her.
"She did not misstep. She was seduced by a conscienceless snake, one promising undying love and matrimony. He cozened her consent and her affections with his lies, and then he betrayed her trust.
All true enough, and yet young ladies were warned almost from birth against such scoundrels. Sherborne would start warning his daughters from the moment of their conception.
He offered marriage?
He did, on bended knee. I am very glad your proposal wasn't offered from that ridiculous posture. He gave her a ring, which I also have, and he got her with child. Fern turned to me only when her situation was past denying. Her own father wanted nothing to do with her, but her brother agreed to take her in, and he and his wife are raising the child.
Insight lifted a burden from Sherborne's memory.
Your old friend, Mr. Porter.
The very one. He might have been as hypocritical as his father, but I promised him sufficient coin to raise the boy, and in the end he and his wife were kind to Fern.
Would they have been as kind without Charlotte's money?
You are supporting the child.
Charlotte shot him a glance over her shoulder.
You are now, indirectly. I set aside a sum from my pin money. Do you mind?
Sherborne did not dare mind.
I mind that you didn't tell me. I don't begrudge the lad necessities when I was raised with every comfort.
Few would come to the aid of a fallen woman as you have, Charlotte. Your loyalty is commendable. Charlotte rose and folded the quilt over the reading chair.
Is there more you would say? I intend to continue supporting the boy, Lucas. His father's sins are not his fault.
Sherborne stood and took her hand. Her palm was hot and damp, her cheeks red, and her eyes glittery with spent tears. The lock of hair he'd cut short curled up at an odd angle by her jaw. His wife was far from composed in her present state, and yet she was dear.
The failings of the boy's mother are also not of his making. Anybody with human parents should agree with you there. If we're to believe our history books, King William himself was the child of a fallen woman.
Charlotte withdrew her hand.
Fallen woman, Lucas? You call my friend a fallen woman? Why do you not refer to Brantford as a fallen man? Why is there never any such creature as a fallen man?
Charlotte paced to the hearth, indignation ringing with every footfall.
When did Fern fall from honour? When she rebuked his lordship for his inappropriate correspondence? When she avoided him in London? When she believed his lies and trusted his promises? Why call her fallen, when with malice aforethought and a dash of casual violence, Brantford despoiled her, ruined her, got her with child, cast her out, made no provision for his own progeny, and none for the mother of his child either?
Skirts swishing, Charlotte paced before the fire.
Tell me again why my friend, who died after delivering Brantford's unclaimed son, is fallen, while his lordship is worth all the hours you put in at the colliery, all the late nights, all the careful estimates and hard work. Why should that man be allowed to continue to draw breath, much less profit from your efforts, while he does?
Too late, Sherborne realized he was in the midst of a negotiation. Charlotte had a grievance. In the truest sense of the word, she grieved for her friend, and for the trust any young woman expected to be able to place in male decency. Both were gone, one just as surely as the other, which could not be helped.
Charlotte, my fate has now become entangled with Brentford's. He was in the wrong where Miss Porter was concerned. Without doubt he was in the wrong. But we cannot change the past.
Charlotte was sensible. She'd have to accept that reasoning. She marched up to him, and despite her blotchy complexion, flyaway curls, and red nose, Sherborne resisted the impulse to step back.
"I do not expect you to change the past, though God knows I've wished I could. I do, however, expect you to change the future. Cut your ties with Brantford, Lucas. He's not worth your time, your coin, or your passing thoughts. Cut him out of our lives, and do what you can to limit his access to anybody from whom he might profit. That much is in your grasp. and I'll content myself with it if I must."
The expectation in her eyes, the righteous certainty that Sherborne would not fail her, made him want to howl.
"What you ask is impossible. I signed a contract. I gave my word, and Brantford has already let it be known I'm to improve on the terms agreed to, not renege on them."
Charlotte's regard shifted to the steady, gimlet gaze he'd seen her turn on a presuming lordling, the same look she'd give a streak of bird droppings on a park bench.
"You don't even like Brantford. You don't trust him. You regret your association with him, and now you know he's dishonoured a decent young woman and ignored his own child. Why would you choose his part over the honourable path?"
Charlotte's question confused so many conflicting priorities and emotions. She wasn't wrong for asking, but she was Sherborne's wife, had taken vows to cleave to him, forsaking all others, even the memory of her departed friend.
"He ruined a young woman," Sherborne said. "Now he can ruin me. If I let that happen, it will do nothing to right the wrongs of the past, and everything to imperil the future of our own children. Is that what you want?"
"We have no children," Charlotte said, glancing around the library as if unsure how she'd come to be there. "If, for better or for worse, you choose to earn coin for the Earl of Brantford, knowing what you do about him, then I can assure you, Mr. Sherborne, we never will."
He tried to fathom what that ominously calm pronouncement meant, as Charlotte crossed to the desk and drew something gold from a skirt pocket, his plainest cravat pin.
"I told myself I could keep this with me, in case you ever needed a spare."
She set the little gold accessory on the blotter beside her hairpin.
"What I really wanted was a token to remind me of the decent, dear, worthy man whom some miracle of fate placed at my side."
Sherborne remained alone by the hearth, angry, sad, resentful, and impressed, while Charlotte quietly left the room.
"I understand why you didn't tell Mr. Sherborne," Elizabeth said,
choosing a bench near a window dripping with condensation.
"But why not tell me, Charlotte? I'm your sister, and I did notice when your best friend disappeared from London without a word of explanation."
The Haverford conservatory was full of plants, brought in from the terraces and gardens in anticipation of cold weather. The greenery should have been soothing, and the fecund, earthy scent comforting.
"Fern was owed my silence," Charlotte said, remaining on her feet. "I feel like ripping apart everything I see, like smashing every pot. That contemptible, putrid excrescence on the face of manhood bowed over my hand, Elizabeth."
Charlotte had washed her hands thoroughly before summoning her gig and departing for the castle. She was hungry, queasy, wrung out from crying, and heartbroken over her discussion with Sherborne. And Elizabeth, so serene and composed on her bench, was no help at all.
"Be that as it may, Charles, had you thought to confide in me, in any of your family, regarding Miss Porter's situation, we might have been able to help."
"Fern was my friend."
Charlotte sank onto a plain wooden chair, worn grey with age.
"She asked me not to interfere, not to risk tainting my own name with scandal. We could have helped with the boy."
"Not with ruining Brantford, or holding him responsible, of course."
"My husband is allowing my support of the child. Evander will continue to thrive."
Which was something. Sherborne had not quibbled at that expenditure for an instant. Charlotte plucked a dead bloom from the nearest potted chrysanthemum.
"Bethan, what am I to do?"
Weeping was such a lot of bother. It left a woman exhausted, unlovely, and predisposed to repeating the indignity. Sherborne had been so kind, so patient, until he'd made Charlotte so angry.
"You must choose your own course, Charlotte. Anyone would find this contretemps vexing."
Charlotte twisted off another spent blossom.
"I do find the situation vexing."
Terribly and completely, and yet the facts were straightforward. Brantford had not been held accountable, for Sherborne to enrich the Earl was absolutely wrong. For Fern to have been disgraced was wrong. Everything was wrong.
I have been so certain for so long that I knew the difference between right and wrong, Bethan. I took vows, the only vows I've spoken in my entire life. I'm supposed to honour my husband, and I do. But Fern was lied to and ruined. Brantford was and is in the wrong.
Sherborne would be in the wrong, Elizabeth said, if he let Brantford's threats similarly ruin the colliery. I agree, it's complicated.
No help at all. Charlotte tossed the dead flowers among the pruned roses and pushed to her feet.
I shall be going, then. Thank you for listening.
Elizabeth took up a watering can and gave an enormous feathery fern a drink.
You are always welcome here, Charlotte. If Sherborne should prove difficult, or his temper unruly, don't be so proud again. Come here, and let him stand outside the castle walls, begging you to relent. It might do him good, and Haverford would enjoy the very sight.
That Elizabeth would imply Sherborne should be humbled for the Duke's entertainment was infuriating, and thus Charlotte's resentment latched on to an additional target.
Haverford's requirements for this mine are a large part of the reason Sherborne took on a junior investor. The colliery is exorbitantly expensive to set up on Haverford's terms, many of which are more luxury than necessity, from what I've read about mining operations.
Elizabeth's watering can had a slow leak, dripping from the bottom. A fat droplet hit the Duchess's ivory satin slipper, while she aimed an unreadable look at Charlotte.
You have ever had the gift of direct speech, sister, though sometimes your words come close to criticizing a family member. I have always thought you couldn't help it, that you must speak the truth, however flawed your perception of it might be.
Faced with Elizabeth's gracious understanding, Charlotte grasped exactly why Sherborne had no patience with his titled neighbours.
Haverford knows next to nothing about mines.
Charlotte pulled her driving gloves out of her reticule and jerked them on.
That is not an insult. That is a fact. His Grace's ignorance did not stop him from dictating to Sherborne many details of the colliery's appointments, and they are expensive details. I could lend Haverford some books, big, heavy, bound books, and then you might believe me.
Drip, drip, drip. Thunk. Elizabeth set the watering can on the table, where it would doubtless leak for the next 2 hours and warp the wood. Charlotte did not care.
"You are upset," Elizabeth said, sounding very much like their auntie, the Duchess of Morland. "I will overlook your tone, because when I believed that Haverford and I were to part, I was a wreck. Now you tell me I'm a wreck, and take on your older sister of doom voice. I am not wrong, Elizabeth. Haverford dictated terms in ignorance, and Brantford is awful, and sometimes I think not a single adult male should be allowed out without a nanny."
Charlotte set the watering can onto the packed earth floor, battered aside a gauzy frond of foliage, and marched to the door. She jerked on the door latch, but the humidity of the conservatory had made the mechanism unreliable. She was still rattling the door when Elizabeth's arms came around her.
"You love him," she said. "You love Sherborne, else you'd never be this overwrought. You love that man like you've never loved another."
Charlotte's ire subsided to the bright, steady flame of indignation she'd carried, thanks to Brantford, for years.
"Love isn't supposed to hurt, Bethan. Not like this. Never like this."
"You've been hurting for a long time," Elizabeth said, stepping back.
"I didn't see it. Probably nobody saw it. But now you can't look away from it. That's good, Charles. We can't heal wounds that remain unacknowledged. I'll say something to Haverford about the mines."
Sherborne had seen the bewilderment behind Charlotte's exasperation and testiness, and abruptly, all Charlotte wanted was to assure herself that her husband was whole and well. She longed to hear the decisive click of his abacus, to feel the muscular security of his arms about her in the dark.
"I'm sorry for my temper," she said. "You're right. I am terribly overset."
Charlotte saw herself out, and as the horse trotted back to Sherborne Hall, she admitted that Elizabeth was right about something else, too. Charlotte loved her husband, loved him with an abiding respect that had been a significant relief, given how few men she encountered who bothered to earn her esteem. Sherborne was at the top of that very short list, and if he should tumble, felled by financial pride, Charlotte's heart would never recover. Chapter 19. A frisson of sympathy for Hannibal Jones stole through Sherborne's mind as he stared at the figures on the page. Charlotte would delight in deciphering these crabbed calculations, would have delighted in them, had she not stormed off to the safety of her sister's castle, likely never to be seen again. For the first time in his life, Sherborne was tempted to consume a quantity of strong drink. Perhaps that was Hannibal Jones's problem. He drank because Mrs. Jones was lost to him forever. If Sherborne mourned abandonment by his wife after less than a month of marriage, what must Jones be suffering, and how must that affect his concentration? The library door clicked open, and Sherborne tossed down his pen, ready to rebuke any footman who'd failed to knock when the master was intent on brooding away the evening, brooding and possibly getting drunk.
"I missed luncheon, and my sister failed to offer sustenance," Charlotte said. "I've ordered a tray."
The relief that coursed through Sherborne was undignified and nearly complete, but for a thin vein of resentment running near his pride. He rose and remained behind his desk rather than approach his wife.
"Mrs. Sherborne, good afternoon."
"Darkness has fallen. I am sorry for my earlier temper, for I ought not to have spoken to my lawfully wedded husband in anger. And yet I am angry still."
She could be furious, and he'd still rejoice that she hadn't left him yet. Though if she intended to cling to her anger, then Sherborne could feel less guilty about his own. Charlotte was no longer in her driving ensemble. She wore a day dress of unrelieved brown, her hair was ruthlessly caught up in a chignon, and no trace of her earlier tears remained. She reminded him of the acerbic young woman who'd endured a bumbling proposal from Viscount Needleby.
"Your ire is understandable."
Sherborne was prepared to be gracious but firm, and thus he sidestepped the word justified. Charlotte gave the globe a spin.
"Then you're willing to cut Brantford loose?"
"Of course not. I've signed a contract with him, and he'll be difficult if I'm anything other than generously accommodating."
"I see."
Sherborne knew better. He knew better than to take that bit of bait, redolent with wifely indignation.
"What do you see?"
She spun the globe the opposite direction.
"I see that honour ceases to matter when a man's business interests are at stake. I had thought a gentleman's honour ought to be more scrupulously in evidence where coin is apt to tempt him from the path of decency. I see that I was wrong. Profit renders honour null and void."
Her finger trailed along the spinning surface of the globe, a diversion children enjoyed. When the sphere came to a stop, she was touching darkest Peru.
"I esteem you above all others," she went on. "You persist in the face of discouragement. You have a vision for the nation's future that encompasses all walks of life, not simply your own interests. You can admit when you've erred, and that makes the present situation all the more baffling, because Brantford is so very, very wrong. He has no place in your affairs."
Sherborne would have agreed with her, but for the requirement that an honourable man provide for his dependents and keep his word at all times.
"This gets us nowhere, Charlotte."
"Where do you want us to be?"
She spared the desk a glance, where the hairpin and cravat pin lay side by side in the silver pen tray. Sherborne had tucked the beribboned lock of hair he'd snipped earlier into his breast pocket.
"I would like to be back to the place we occupied before Brantford intruded on our marriage. You are my wife, and I esteem you above all others as well. That hasn't changed."